You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to History of the Second World War, Episode 154, The Early War at Sea, Part 4, Opening Moves. This week, a big thank you goes out to B, Eric, Gorin, David, Cam, and Ryan for choosing to support the podcast by becoming members. You can find out more over at historyofthesecondworldwar.com/members. The early months of the Second World War in Europe were an interesting time for the war at sea. Now, this was not due to major naval actions like what the Japanese would launch at the start of the war in the Pacific, but instead due to the scattered actions of the Kriegsmarine and the somewhat frantic actions of the Royal Navy to answer them. From basically the very beginning of the war, there would be 2 trends that would become apparent, and they would kind of stick around until well into 1941. The first theme was that the Kriegsmarine never had enough ships, either underwater or surface ships, to accomplish the goals that they were going for, which was primarily commerce raiding with some attacks on the British fleet. But simply due to a lack of resources, those actions really could not change the course of the war, even if they had some successes or small successes, and they certainly couldn't decisively influence British trade. On the opposite side, the theme for the Royal Navy was unrelenting frustration that was only broken by periodic victories. We will discuss this frustration in great detail starting in episode 6 of this series, during which we will cover the actions of the 2 Panzerschiffe that would be in position to do some commerce raiding when the war started. And then we will cover another area of great frustration starting in episode 9, which will cover the actions of German U-boats. But this frustration would also manifest in more subtle and less obvious ways. For example, attacks on Scapa Flow, the traditional fleet anchorage, from both the air and by U-boats, would force the fleet to move to western Scotland, making it more difficult to project power into the North Sea, and to control the actions of German surface raiders. Those same surface raiders would then force the Royal Navy to spread its forces out to try and guard the convoys that were plying the northern Atlantic and western approaches, making it difficult for the Royal Navy to concentrate forces against any single German threat. It was, or would be, a disappointing beginning for a navy that prided itself on its tremendous strength and its general competency. This episode will focus on the very beginning of the war and some of the first actions taken by both sides in the conflict, particularly around the merchant fleets of both navies. Now, we've talked a lot about the navies of Germany and Britain up to this point in the podcast, and have really focused on the military side of that planning. But a critical piece of planning for both Britain and Germany before the war had nothing to do with battleships, aircraft, submarines, anything with guns on it, but instead all revolved around merchant shipping. This is because when the German U-boat campaign was being planned, it had nothing to do with the contents of the ships that were being sunk. Yes, it was great that the contents of those ships were not reaching Britain or wherever their destination might be, but the most important thing was that the ship that was carrying those contents was at the bottom of the ocean instead of being able to carry further cargo. This is a fact that's easy to miss because most statistics about the U-boat campaign focus on the tonnage of material or tonnage of the ships sank. But the most important number for the long-term success of the German efforts was the reduction in the total carrying capacity of the merchant ships available to the British Merchant Marine. This is one of the reasons that the entry of the United States into the war was such a critical moment for the Battle of the Atlantic, because the mass creation of Liberty ships, which were really just simple but very easy to mass produce merchant ships, meant that no matter how many ships the U-boats sank, they could never make headway against the total shipping tonnage of the Allied merchant fleets. At the start of the war, the British were obviously a few years away from those Liberty ships, but they did have a merchant fleet with a carrying capacity of 21 million tons, which was a lot, but was also not enough. This fact became clear shortly after the start of the war, when even that many merchant ships, 21 million tons, were not able to fully support the needs of the British economy as it tried to ramp up war production. This problem only became worse due to both the number of ships that were sunk during the first months of the war, many of which were actually sunk by mines and not U-boats, but it was also exacerbated by the inefficiencies that were introduced into the trade system by convoys. The convoy system, by its very nature, slowed down trade, something that greatly displeased ship owners, because it required the ships to get together, then sail across on the speed of the slowest ship, and then disperse on the other end. But unlike during the First World War, during which the Royal Navy resisted the introduction of convoys, the introduction of a system of convoying was a critical part of British war plans, and at the very start of the war, a system was set up whereby ships were grouped together into convoys based on destination and speed. The exact speed of the convoy was critical due to the importance of station keeping within the convoy, especially when the convoy started zigzagging to avoid U-boats. The movements of a convoy were generally complicated enough that there would be a conference before any convoy departed, where the masters, chief engineers, and wireless operators of all of the merchantmen would come together to be briefed on expected speed, wireless codes, and zigzag patterns. All of these items had to be discussed beforehand, and then also there had to be a coordinated plan for what to happen in case of an attack. Otherwise, there was a risk of ships sort of colliding and sinking each other and doing the Germans' jobs for them. Or there could also just be general confusion, so there were plans for what happened in case of an attack. But this put a lot of strain on the masters of these ships that was often not present during peacetime operations. It made it very hard for them during these years of the war. At the beginning of the war, there were some exceptions to convoys, though. And this was particularly around ships that were faster or slower than kind of the convoy speed band, which was about 9 to 15 knots. Ships that were faster than 15 knots were kind of operating under the assumption that they were able to move fast enough to outpace the U-boats that were hunting for them. And so they should just blast through the danger zone as quickly as possible, because that would actually be safer than going slower with a convoy. This would eventually be changed, especially as the number of faster ships grew, and they could be grouped into faster convoys. Slower ships, or those that were incapable of matching the 9-knot convoy speed, were also not included, due to fears that a slower speed would just make the convoy more vulnerable. The vulnerability of slower ships eventually meant that they would also be grouped into convoys. They were just convoys that matched the slower speed that they were capable of. The final group of merchant ships that were initially excluded from convoys were neutral merchant ships, which were often either bound for Britain or neutral ports. They would also be added into the convoy system, especially as their importance to British shipping would grow after only a few weeks of war. The first group of neutral shipping to join the British merchant fleet were those of the Polish Merchant Marine, very shortly after the war started. After the invasion of Poland, any Poland-flagged vessels that were not captured by the Germans were integrated into the British shipping fleet. They would then later be joined by the ships of many other nations, particularly those of Denmark, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Norway. These ships were a critical area of expansion for the British merchant fleet, and greatly reduced the impact of the early victories of the U-boats and the losses suffered due to German mines. The cooperation between the ships of those nations and British plans began before German ground forces actually invaded many of those countries, because they worked very closely with the British government through the creation of bilateral shipping agreements. There was a risk of joining British convoys, but this could be offset by insurance guarantees by the British government, and there was no shortage of money floating around to pay for the ships and the cargo that they could carry. The British Merchant Marine would also prepare for the war by arming themselves. The process of getting at least some merchant ships armed began as early as the Munich crisis, when the British Ministry of Shipping started to work with some ship owners to strengthen the decks and weld on mountings that could later be used to mount 4 or 6 inch guns on the ships that would hopefully provide at least some protection from German surface ships and surfaced submarines. The guns would begin to be mounted in June 1939, as war seemed imminent, and the efforts were coordinated by the Admiralty Trade Division. This was made much easier due to the large number of 4 and 6 inch guns that were kind of just sitting in British warehouses after the ships that originally housed them had been broken up during the 1920s due to the Washington Naval Treaty. Now, the efficacy of these guns was questionable, but if nothing else, it gave the merchant fleet at least the illusion that they would be able to defend themselves. There would also be attempts to use merchant ships in a more dedicated military role in the form of armored merchant cruisers, or AMCs. AMCs were a topic that both Britain and Germany would spend a good amount of thought and resources on before the war, under the theory that faster merchant ships might be a good supplement to the fleets of both nations as they tried to prevent the trade of the other or protect their own trade from attack. The results of these AMCs would be disappointing at best, and a complete failure at worst, with British AMCs proving to be very vulnerable to both German surface ships, particularly Panzerschiff, and also incapable of protecting British convoys from German submarines. This would result in a de-emphasis of the AMC concept in December 1939, with a reallocation of any resources for more AMC conversions being placed into simply a greater emphasis on the construction of dedicated convoy escort vessels. Now, the importance of British trade is a topic that I'm sure very few listeners of this podcast are surprised by. It plays such a critical role in the telling of any history of Britain in the Second World War. A topic that gets less discussion is the fate and importance of the German merchant fleet. When the war started, around 400 German merchant ships were abroad, and the Royal Navy would spend the first several months of the war making an effort to either sink them or at least prevent them from returning to Germany. This would be accomplished both by actively hunting them down in various areas around the world, but also simply maintaining a loose blockade of the North Sea to prevent them from returning home. This would not prevent many of the ships from actually making it back to Germany, though, and up to about April 1940, 82 German merchant ships were able to make it back to Germany. So it's about 82 out of 400. When they arrived back in Germany, some of these ships were able to join the important trade with Scandinavia, with Swedish iron ore being shipped back to Germany, but most of them were unable to really contribute further to the war effort due to British efforts to interdict British trade. This would be accomplished by the Northern Patrol of cruisers and AMCs, which would have their first success on the very first day of the war, with the capture of the 2,377-ton Hanna Boge, south of Iceland. Now you may be wondering why I've spent half an episode just talking about the makeup and plans of the merchant fleets of Germany and Britain. Well, this is mostly because the naval actions of both Britain and Germany would be entirely structured by the trade war for basically the entire war. When looking at land campaigns, it's often critical to talk about geography or rivers or mountains or forests or other geographic features, and they would have critical impact on how armies interacted with one another. Well, for the European naval war, everything would be focused on the attack and defense of British trade. It would entirely dictate almost every action of the German war at sea, either directly or indirectly, really until the end of 1944, early 1945, when they just lost the ability to really do anything. And because it dictated the actions of the Kriegsmarine, it also dictated the actions of the Royal Navy in response.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org.
paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Hey there, I'm Dylan Lewis, one of the hosts of Motley Fool Money. Each weekday on Motley Fool Money, we talk through the business news you need to know and the stories moving stocks on Wall Street. On weekends, we dive into the industries shaping tomorrow and host the experts, authors, and executives that understand them. Tune in for insights, a long-term perspective on investing, and of course, stock ideas, plenty of them. To quote a listener, it pays to listen. Check us out and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Even before the war officially started between Britain and Germany in September 1939, both sides were preparing for war. In Britain, the Royal Naval Reserve and the Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve were at least partially activated starting in June 1939 to man the ships of the reserve fleet that were pulled back into service at that time. Then in late August, very close to the start of the war, a general mobilization of those reserve groups was put in place to put the Royal Navy on a war footing. The activation of these reserves would increase the manpower of the Royal Navy from about 130,000 to over 210,000. This would be just in time because on September 3rd, of course, signals would be issued from London to all British naval units around the world that the nation was at war. The first signal would be issued after 11 a.m. with the simple content of "Most immediate, total Germany," which was a prearranged message that Britain was now at war with Germany and that actions to that effect should be taken immediately. Commander Alistair Ewing would be on board the destroyer Imogen in the Mediterranean when this message arrived, and he would record his thoughts at that time like this. Quote, "At 11 a.m., our ultimatum to Germany expired and we were at war. This called for champagne, not to celebrate, but to mark the occasion. I was rather glad it had come. There could be no other honorable course of action, and during the whole of these last few days, I've had the uncomfortable feeling that our politicians were striving desperately to find an easy way out, like Munich. But it is certainly fighting for an ideal, and it will not be easy to bring any immediate aid to Poland. Italy is apparently not coming in, which simplifies our job at sea 100%. End quote. At the same time, coordination plans with the French were activated, with all French ports closed starting on September 1st when news arrived of the invasion of Poland. These restrictions were reduced as soon as it was obvious that a German invasion of France was not going to happen immediately, and also that Italy was not going to join the war. This allowed the Western Atlantic French ports to open on the 5th, along with the ports in the Mediterranean. In all cases, French ships were subordinated completely to the British convoy system, with the French government essentially handing all of their merchant ships to the British to coordinate and protect as they were moving French trade across the Atlantic. At the same time, the Kriegsmarine was preparing to use its resources to meet its own objectives. One of the first actions taken to meet these objectives was the laying of minefields in the Baltic, which would be done on September 4th, with three mine layers laying minefields totaling 564 mines, effectively closing part of the entrances to the Baltic Sea. Along with this, there would be a concerted effort to interdict all trade in the Baltic, which might be bound for Britain or France. These efforts would largely be successful, but mostly only because most of the shipping bound for Britain and France, including many Polish merchant ships, had already vacated the Baltic due to the threat of war and then the declaration of war on September 1st. This meant that many of the vessels that were stopped and searched by German destroyers were allowed to continue their trade due to their contents and their destinations. The efforts of German U-boats to interdict British trade will be a major topic for later in this series, but it is impossible to discuss any aspects of the preparations for the war and then the first months of the conflict without at least touching on the plans of the U-boats and the plans of the Royal Navy to protect against them. Within the Kriegsmarine, Admiral Karl Dönitz was the lead advocate and the commander of the German U-boat fleet. Dönitz's firm belief was that the U-boats were the path to victory, and unfortunately, those would come into conflict with Raeder's vision that the best path forward for the Kriegsmarine was more of a balanced approach. Surface vessels, U-boats, mines, all those things. Raeder's control of the German Navy meant that resources that could have gone to U-boat construction before the war were used for other purposes. and this meant that the number of U-boats available at the start of the war were far below what Dönitz would have preferred, and really what the Germans needed to actually complete some of their objectives, because U-boat endurance was limited, and the Atlantic, at least at the start of the war, was quite far away. And this often meant that there were only a handful of U-boats on patrol at any given time early in the war. And even then, those numbers were only possible by kind of pulsing operations, with a month of heavy patrolling followed by a month of relatively few patrols as U-boats returned to port, rearmed and refitted before the next pulse out into the Atlantic. There just weren't enough boats to keep a large number out all the time. Even these small numbers, though, would have some effect, seeking around 200,000 tons of shipping in the first few months of the war. In these efforts, they were greatly aided by German signals intelligence. The most popular story of signals intelligence during the early war years would certainly be the efforts of the British codebreakers to read the German Enigma encrypted messages, but on the German side, major efforts were undertaken to decipher and use Allied messages for the aid in all aspects of the war, including directing U-boats and getting them positioned correctly. This would pay off in major ways in the early part of the war because the decryption arm of the German radio monitoring service was able to read almost all Allied radio communications, including those used by the Royal Navy. The ability to read these communications gave the German Navy almost perfect knowledge of the position of British warships and convoys, which allowed them to position their own sparse resources in ways that they were essentially far more useful than they would have otherwise been. Another major boon for the Germans in the early years of the war was the usage of mines. There were major efforts by the German Navy to sow minefields in areas around the North Sea and around Britain through surface vessels, U-boats, and by air. The key was that the Germans had developed a potent magnetic mine before the war, which was more consistent and deadly than contact mines because it could detonate when a ship was passing over it due to the disturbances that the metal hulled ships made in the magnetic field around the mine. These efforts, both in the development of the mines and the efforts to place them, would be vindicated early and often during the war, with more shipping tonnage sank via mines than by U-boats during 1939. The presence of mines and the threat of U-boats would force British efforts and resources to be allocated to countering these threats. In the case of mines, this meant the creation of more and more minesweepers, with almost 600 ships requisitioned for minesweeping duties by the end of the year. These were generally very small coastal vessels, trawlers, yachts, and similar ships that were fitted with minesweeping equipment. Similar efforts were made to bolster the size of British anti-submarine forces. Then there was also a tremendous amount of trust and faith placed in ASDIC, an early form of sonar that was developed during the First World War and then refined during the interwar years. ASDIC used narrow sound waves to detect submarines, which would be discovered when the sound waves bounced off of the submarines and then returned to the vessel where they were detected by hydrophones. And this tool did work, it did function. And there would be 180 different vessels of various sizes with ASDIC sets fitted at the start of the war. But there were many limitations that would reduce the effectiveness of ASDIC below what had been expected during earlier years. The first was simply that ASDIC as a system had limited range, with a maximum possible detection range being only about 2,500 meters, and that range was heavily impacted based on weather conditions and the exact placement and positioning of the submarine. Another challenge was that even with 180 ships equipped with this technology, there just were not enough to go around, and this made it challenging to get groups of ASDIC-equipped ships together to attack submarines in groups. This was critical because the efficacy of ASDIC was greatly impacted by depth charges, especially ones that the ship itself was dropping, and this meant it was often very difficult for a ship that had ASDIC to find the submarine, drop depth charges, and then reacquire the submarine afterwards, which often allowed the submarine to escape. Another challenge was simply that the U-boats really liked to attack convoys at night and on the surface, which removed the ability of ASDIC to detect them at all because they were on the surface. Finally, there simply was not enough trained and experienced ASDIC operators at the start of the war. And that problem only got worse as the number of convoy escort vessels expanded greatly in the first months and years of the war. It would take time for experience to be gained, and there was really no way around that to circumvent that time frame. Luckily for the Royal Navy and for British trade, the Germans did not have as many U-boats as they would have wanted, and so while the U-boats would begin sinking ships almost immediately after the start of the war, there would be time to build up the ability to protect from U-boat attacks before the critical phases of the Battle of the Atlantic would begin in 1940.